Will, go ahead and be turning with me to Exodus 31. We're going to start in Exodus 31, and then we're going to work through some aspects of the tabernacle. Let's go and begin a word of prayer this morning. Al, would you be willing to word of prayer for us? Amen. Well, I'm not actually going to review at the beginning this morning. We're going to review at the end because I just want to make sure I leave enough time for the threefold structure of the tabernacle. If we get this down, the rest of the class is going to be pretty, yeah, that makes sense. If we don't get this down, we are going to be lost as Easter eggs the whole rest of this class. So I really want to make sure we understand this and get this together. And as I said, it's really not that complicated. If you just start reading through Exodus 25 following, it gets really confusing really fast about what's where and how many pieces there are and et cetera, et cetera. But it's really pretty intuitive. So let's go ahead and talk about the threefold structure of the tabernacle. All right, so the image that I'm following is on page 35. This is the one I want you to be filling out. So the one on page 35 is the one without labels. This was a few pages before with labels. But I just want us to work through this, all right? So looking at this diagram, we talked about it that last time. This is the tabernacle itself. This is a replica of the tabernacle in Israel. And working through this tabernacle, there's, of course, various parts and aspects to it. And I just want to get down these basic building blocks, the skeleton of the tabernacle. So let's go ahead and work through our three structures, okay? So if you look at the top of page 34, in this class we'll introduce the tabernacle by overviewing the three main sections. The first is the outer court, all right? So the outer court's number one, the second is the holy place, the third is the holy of holies. Let me work backward. It's actually a bit easier to show, okay? This right here is the Holy of Holies. This one right here, this cube, it's a cube, is the Holy of Holies. All right? It's the Holy of Holies. This one right here is the holy place. And this whole structure right here is called the inner tent. So if you look at our diagram again, you'll note there's actually two tents. There's the outer tent right here that goes around the courtyard, and then there's the inner tent. Everything inside of here contains both the Holy of Holies and the holy place. Okay? So this right here, this little diagram, is this little thing right here. All right? So then, everything else out here is the outer courtyard. Okay, pretty intuitive, right? Pretty intuitive. There's three basic places. You have the holy place, the most holy place, and then the outer courtyard. Okay? Some of you, I'm sure, have studied this many times before. It's new. If you've never gone through this before, it's very, very important just to get this basic skeleton, and then you're able to understand the rest of it in a lot more detail. All right? So let's go ahead and just start talking through some details of this. Again, working backward, who was able to enter into the most holy place? Only the high priest. Only the high priest, okay? So only Aaron and then later his descendants are going to be the only one to go into this cube of the most holy place. Who is able to go into the holy place? Only the priests, okay? Only the priests were allowed to go into the holy place. So, would there be anyone from Judah, Dan, Naphtali in this inner tent? Shouldn't have been. And we'll talk in this class about a few Old Testament examples of people who broke that rule. Do y'all remember any king that broke that rule? Uzziah. So, Margaret, if you remember, Uzziah burned incense. So, he went into this inner tent. He had no right to. Uzziah should have stayed way out here, okay? There's a few other examples. David does something a bit peculiar we'll talk about. But only the Levites, the officiating priests, were allowed in here. And only the high priest was allowed in this section right here. And you know also how that's completely covered? It's completely covered. The veil would have covered the whole thing, completely covered. All right, who then is able to enter into the outer courtyard? There you go, everybody else. Everybody else, okay? Everyone else is allowed to go in here. And not only are they allowed to, they're supposed to. Because notice especially here, this altar of burnt offering. This is going to be one of the first things we talk about. The altar of burnt offering was central to the life of Judah and Israel. So anyone can go out here, but only the priests in here and only the high priest in here. Okay? Questions so far? Dorothy? Great question. We'll talk about that. Let me hold that question off a little bit. It's a complicated answer. Dorothy's question was, if this is where the sacrifices were offered, where were they actually killed? That's very important, actually, when it comes to Jesus. Hebrews 13 makes a connection. This is why I want to hold that off for a second. But we'll talk about that in 2 weeks, I think. And there's actually an important reason about where they're killed versus where they're offered. Good question, though. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's just work through this backward then. So, most holy place. What alone was in the most holy place? Steve? Ark of the Covenant. All right, so if y'all look in your most holy place, there should be two numbers you have in your most holy place. They're the Holy of Holies. Numbers? 11 and 12. Okay? So numbers 11 and 12 should be the only two numbers you have in this box right here. Okay? The Holy of Holies and the Ark of the Covenant. That's it. Okay, continuing to work backward. What separated the most holies from the holy place? A veil. Now, why is that significant? Yeah, this is the veil that was torn whenever Jesus died. The Hebrew author is going to offer a whole chapter of explanation about that veil. Dorothy? Yes, yes, it was. Yeah, Matthew, I think, is the gospel that records that detail where the veil was torn from top to bottom. Very significant, very significant. And also, we'll talk about this veil, y'all. This is not a little just like shawl. This is a veil. Samson could not have torn this thing in two. So it's a heavy piece of garment, and we'll talk about the nature of it. It was very intricately woven. It was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. Does anybody remember some things that were woven into the veil? Well, good. That's why we're having this class. Okay? We'll talk about that in a couple months. All right. So your veil, of course, is your number 10, should be right there. Okay? All right, so your holy place has how many different objects in it? Three. There's three objects in the holy place. Three objects in the holy place. I'm just going to work through the numbers here. Number seven is your table of bread, which is this one right here, or show bread. And y'all, don't get confused by the names. Different translations and even different passages call the same thing different names. So don't let the names confuse you. The table of bread, table of show bread, same thing. Don't let the names confuse you. So this right here is the table of bread. How many pieces of bread were on that table? Good, we'll learn that. 12 is the right answer. There were 12, yeah. Two stacks, but 12 total. We'll talk about the significance of that. Okay, so that is your number 7, is your table of bread right here. The lampstand, number 8, is right here. Also called the menorah or the candlestick. Okay, it's really a candlestick. There were candles and oil that flowed. So this right here is your lampstand. Your lampstand. What was the only thing that was allowed to give light to the most holy place? The lampstand. Yeah, I will tell you all from the get-go, this is my favorite piece of the whole tabernacle. I'll explain why as we talk about it, but I could do a whole class just on the lampstand. The table of bread and everything's interesting. The lampstand is fascinating. It is all throughout the scriptures. And it's very important whenever you come to the New Testament. We'll talk about why. I won't give away all the spoilers now, but I love the lampstand. Cannot wait to tell y'all some things about the lampstand. All right? And so then, that would mean number 9, the altar of incense, is this right here. Okay? That's the altar of incense. Okay? So there was only one thing in the most holy place, the Ark of the Covenant. You have the altar of incense, the golden candlestick, and the table of showbread right here. So do some reasoning here. Who were the only group of people allowed to use the altar of incense? Priest. Okay? There will be a whole chapter given in Exodus about the incense and who does what in what way. There's a lot of detail given to that. The table of showbread, who were the only people allowed to eat it? The priest, okay? Only the priest. And there's actually details given about when they could eat it, how much they could eat, etc. A lot of detail will be given about this, all right? And then, of course, our lampstand right there. So then, it's called the door. The door, really another veil right here, the outer veil for the outer tent, is going to be woven over the whole holy place. Okay? And as I said, there's actually a whole chapter about the intricacies of what that should look like, the measurements, etc. A lot of detail given to that. So this is our outer door right here. Okay? What do y'all think Jesus meant whenever he said, "I am the door"? It's tabernacle imagery. I'll show y'all that and make some connections to that. When Jesus said, "I am the door," it's tabernacle imagery. All right? So that should take us then through number 5. Okay? Any questions about 6 through 12? Any questions about this? Okay. So number 5, as I said, is right here. Number 5 is right there. And then, let me go and ask this as well. You'll notice on your drawing on page 35, there are these little check boxes. What are those? Good. It's a good question, isn't it? What are those? Look at your diagram. Those are just pillars. They're just pillars. Okay. Pillars. Columns. Yeah, just hold stuff up. That's all it is. Yeah. All right. So number 4 then. Where should your number 4 go for the outer courtyard? Yeah, I'm seeing Jerry do the hand motion. Anywhere. Anywhere. You would enter right through here. You would enter through here. But all of this area right here is your outer courtyard. All of that area is the outer courtyard. All right? So the laver, it's my least favorite name. Has anybody ever used the word laver in their life? I've not. What's a better name for it? A what? A lavatory, right? There's a British word. A lavatory, okay? A basin, yeah. If you want to be country about it, this is a wash tub, okay? So this is really what it was. It's a wash tub. And there are some translations that'll just call it a wash basin is one word for it. But this is just where there's water there, okay? So this right here is the laver. This is the laver. So I've already given the answer away, but what was in the laver? Water. Yeah, there's water in the laver. Okay, water and the laver. Okay. Then the brazen altar is this one right here. Again, don't let the names confuse you, but that's this one right here. Why is it called the brazen altar? What does brazen mean? Made of bronze. Yeah, made of bronze. Brazen means made of bronze. So this right here is your brazen altar, also called your altar of burnt offerings. Altar of burnt offerings. Okay? Jane, something on your mind? Yeah, good point, yeah. And we'll talk about the construction of this. This right here was melted down, etc. As you work through here, there's going to be gold. A lot of that's going to be overlaid. But I'm going to have to check on this, but I'm pretty sure this was pure bronze. This was pure bronze. It was brazen down from the bronze and then melted from that. So the construction of those is going to be a little bit different because this right here is acacia wood overlaid with gold, whereas this is going to be brazen down. And so then, process of elimination, your outer gate is right here. That's your outer gate right here. One way to come in, one way to go out. That's your outer gate. Which way did it face? East. It's very important as you work through the prophets. It faces east. Okay, I know that was not the most interesting 20 minutes of class that I've ever taught, but it is important. If you get this basic thing in your head, the rest of the class is very simple. If we're still struggling with this, it's going to get pretty confusing pretty fast. So let's review just real quick. How many objects were in the most holy place? One. And what was that, Lois? The Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant. All right. How many objects were in the holy place? Three. Who could enter the holy place? Only the priest. Okay. Let's start naming those off. What were the three objects in the holy place? Lampstand. Table of showbread. And altar of incense. Okay, so the three were the lampstand, the altar of incense, and the table of showbread. Okay, those are the three things in the holy place. What overlaid the inner tent? What overlaid it? What was on top of it? Not a trick question. A veil. A veil separates them, and there's a veil on the outside as well. Okay, who was the only person that could go into the most holy place? Yeah, Aaron, the high priest, okay? The outer courtyard, who could enter it? Anybody. How many objects were in it? Two. They were the wash basin and the altar of burnt offerings. Altar of burnt offerings, those were the two. Yes, Lois. That is an excellent question. I'll repeat it. Lois asked the question, were women allowed in the outer courtyard area? That is a controversial question, Lois. because the question gets down to, were women allowed to offer burnt offerings? That's the question. And sadly, there is not a clear answer on that in Leviticus or anywhere in the Old Testament. Okay? My personal inclination, whenever we talk about the altar of burnt offerings, I'll bring some of these passages up. It seems to me that women were allowed. Some would argue they weren't, but it seems to me yes. Now, I can say more definitively, women were not allowed in this area right here, okay? One of the reasons I say that is, I can't remember the verse off the top of my head, but it's somewhere in chapter 38 or 39. There are ministering women that were said to be in the tabernacle. I am very confident that that's talking about ministering women, especially Levites, who were helping in this area through here. So with those two things in mind, given it seems women were allowed to offer burnt offerings, and we know definitively that women were ministering in the tabernacle in some sense, it seems yes. Yeah, and I can get that passage for you. It's just not coming to my mind off top. Say again. 38:8. Let's read that real quick, Jerry. Y'all go to Exodus 38:8. Very good. Thank you. 38:8. Exodus 38:8. 38:8. 38:8. Yeah. And another reason that's an excellent question, Lois, is there's not many ministering women mentioned in Exodus 25 through 40. But great question. Really good question. All right, other questions before we go on, Charlene? Yeah, good question. Okay. So Charlene's question was, did every individual Israelite go to this place right here to offer a burnt offering every time a sacrifice was required? There's estimated, we don't get a great number. It's estimated about 1 million people, men, women, and children, came out of the Exodus. Did 1 million people come here every day? Yeah. Yeah, it would have been very crowded. Thoughts? No. No. This is where I'm going to try to start challenging some of our individualistic Christian assumptions about this. We, of course, think of salvation in individual terms, right? You believe in Christ, repent of your sins, confess his name, be baptized, and then, by obedient faith, you're saved. For Israel, this was not a matter of salvation. This was not a matter of salvation. They were already saved from Egypt. This was to allow their atonement that they could remain in fellowship with God. This was going to be much more ritual. And I don't mean that negatively at all. But this is much more ritual for Israel rather than it is, I've sinned today, I need to go make atonement. What it seems, and Leviticus does fill in some of the gaps for us here, there would have been heads of family, heads of tribes, etc., that would have represented the people, and they would have taken many of the sacrifices in. And so it doesn't seem that every individual Israelite was taking a sacrifice. There would have been representatives who would have done it as well. Yeah, but good question. Other questions? But y'all know how foreign this is to us, right? I mean, there's nothing. I mean, there is nothing in our culture I could point to and say this is kind of like the sacrificial system of Israel. I just couldn't think of anything. Otis. Sure. Sure. Yeah. And I see where you're coming from, Otis. Even there, I'm like, but that's still antiquity. So definitely it's a part of our heritage, right? But still, there's nothing in our modern culture that's just like, this is the central pagan area. You can definitely go back through history, and every culture of all time has had something like this. But in 21st century America, especially among Anglos, there's not something that's just equivalent to this. It seems much more antiquated. Yeah. Yeah, but good connection. Jerry. No. 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 Whenever we talk about the nature of this veil and this veil, absolutely not. Ain't no way possible. Yeah, Jerry asked if you were able to see into the most holy place from the outer courtyard. No. Oh, the holy place? Let me double check into that one. Yeah, I need to go back and look at some measurements of the veil. I'm not sure. Yeah, Bonnie? Yes. Great question. Okay, here's Bonnie's question. So modern day Jews still, of course, believe in Torah, Pentateuch. So they believe in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, where all this is prescribed. When did they, as a nation, stop offering these sacrifices? It's a very important year. Any guesses? Comes right after AD 69. AD 70. What happened in AD 70? Destruction of the temple. Destruction of the temple. So in 70 AD, about 35 years or so after Jesus dies, the Romans come in and wipe out Herod's temple. Wipe it out. Okay? And they can't. At that point in AD 70, the scrolls that contained much of the lineage were burned. And the sacrificial, the genealogy, every part of the Jewish system was decimated at that point. Ever since AD 70, it has been impossible for Israel to offer these sacrifices. Now, deal with 2020, what is at the physical location where Solomon's temple and Herod's temple was? Yeah, Dome of the Rock. Yeah, the mosque is that there. So you understand for the Jews why this is so important, is that's where Abraham offered Isaac. That's where David made a census and had atonement. That's where Solomon built his temple. That's where Zerubbabel relayed the cornerstone. For them, that's very, very, very important. But a mosque has now been there. And so that's why it's impossible for them to offer these sacrifices. Yeah, and the other reason, as Karen said, is they don't have the specific genealogies to tell who the high priest should be. And so without that Levitical record, it's impossible to have these sacrifices in a pleasing manner to God. AD 70, yeah. You can actually go through secular history, and this is a very well-documented event. We even know to the day. Other questions? Well, great question, John. I'm glad to see this is causing some thought and questions to come to mind. Because as I said, this is foreign. I was not raised at a tabernacle with a laver. I've never really offered a burnt offering, to my knowledge. This is foreign to us. But I do think it's very important. Now let's talk about why. Let's talk about why, okay? So I want to review just a little bit from last week, and then we'll go back through and trace a few of these verses in Exodus. Just for quick review, y'all go back with me to Hebrews chapter 8, please. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 8. I'm going to look at a couple of these verses just, again, to refresh our minds. So I don't have these verses on here. We talked about these last week, but look down to question 3 is where you can start filling in some of these notes. Just as quick review. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. Terry, will you read that, please? Okay, so we talked about this last time, but all of these things right here, okay, all of these things right here are a what of heavenly things, a pattern, a shadow, a symbol, a parable, a copy, okay? These are but mere copy of heavenly things. Now, Robin Embry made this point with me last week, and it was a great point. Y'all know many, many times I've talked about how the Old Testament shadows the New Testament. So the Old Testament's the shadow, the New Testament's the substance. This is not Old Testament, New Testament, shadow, substance. This is earth, heaven, shadow, substance. Does that make sense? What we're seeing here, and this is what the Hebrew author is doing, is showing us these earthly things were but copies, parables, symbols of heavenly things. So this is where he's using physical things on earth as parable, symbol, illustration, copy of heavenly things. Jerry? Okay. Okay, a couple more verses. Look over to Hebrews chapter 9. I didn't read this one last time for the sake of time, but I think it's the clearest. Jane, if you will, Hebrews 9, 23 and 24. Very good. Now, we're going to work through this one just for a minute because this is a fascinating verse. Look first of all at verse 24. Where did Jesus enter to make atonement for sin? Into heaven. Okay? Jesus entered into heaven itself to make atonement for sin. He has appeared into the very presence of God. Okay? But all of these earthly things, again, are but mere copies of true things, of heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Is it any coincidence that when you look at throne scenes of God, what surrounds God's throne in Ezekiel and Isaiah, etc.? And more specifically, cherubim. What's over the Ark of the Covenant? Cherubim. The cherubim were but mere copy. They were but mere shadow of heavenly things. Okay? Jesus entered into the heavenly holy place to make atonement for sin. But understand, this is but mere copy. Ben made an excellent point about this on Wednesday I want to share. That's the great thing about teaching this class two times. Is I get so many comments both times I get to share. So Ben made the point that any symbol, of course, has to be connected properly. Let me explain what I mean by this. I asked the question like I did of y'all, tell me something in your home that tells me about yourself. Sharon said she has a wooden carving of Kentucky in her home. Now, what does that wooden carving of Kentucky show about Sharon? Her origin, where she comes from. No, that doesn't. It shows that she likes wood. Right. Now, Karen's right, okay? It shows she comes from Monroe County, and she's proud of it. Don't know why, but she comes from Monroe County. Nothing's in Monroe County. She loves Kentucky, she loves where she's from, loves her heritage, etc. That's what that shows, right? That does not show that she loves wood. Likewise here, we have to be precise with our symbolism to see what is the ark really showing us about God's presence? What is the table actually showing us about God's presence? Okay? And that's... We'll work through this, and we're going to let the text guide us as we go through this. But these everything here is but mere copy or shadow of heavenly things. But what are they telling us about heaven itself? Now, one more thing about this passage. If you look back to Hebrews 9:23, did y'all notice anything fascinating about this passage? What had to happen to the heavenly things? They had to be purified. Heaven had to be purified. Okay. Thus, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things, that is, the things in the Levitical tabernacle, to be purified with these rites. But the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. What does that last part mean? Now, this last part is an incomplete sentence. Let me try to fill in the parallelism here. Thus, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves had to be purified with better sacrifices than these. Yeah, the atoning blood of Christ. Heaven had to be atoned for? What? What in the world does that mean? We'll talk about that. But what the Hebrew author is saying here is the heavenly things had to be purified. Now, to figure out what that means, we will figure out what does the purification of all of these items mean, and I don't think it's that bizarre of an answer. But I want us just to remember, whenever we study the tabernacle, what are we studying a copy of? Heaven itself. Otis. Go ahead. Great question. Great question. Have you read Plato? Not much. Okay, so I thought you may be coming from a Platonic area here. Okay. Otis asked the question. It's an excellent, excellent, excellent question. Is this saying that there is a direct relationship, perhaps even a causal relationship, between something is done to these earthly objects and then necessarily something is done to the earthly objects? Heaven. Okay? The heavenly objects. My short answer to that would be no. Okay? My reason for that is, let me give a 30-second explanation to this. What the Hebrew author is doing here is, I think, drawing from some of Plato's ideas. Plato had the idea that everything physical had an intangible object that was a one-to-one relationship with it. So Plato had the idea, it's called the forms, the caves, is where he expounded on this, that if something happens physically to this, everything on earth has something that's intangible that then it connects with. I don't think that's what the Hebrew author is doing here. I think what he's saying is, understand, these are parables for us. These are symbols for us just to try to help us begin to understand what Jesus did at the cross. I think more what he's saying is not, okay, so the Ark of the Covenant was ransacked by the Babylonians. Well, then the heavenly one got ransacked. I don't think that's his point. I think his point is much more, learn about the Ark, learn about its structure, its nature, who went to it, what happened with it, its purpose, etc. And that's going to get you to begin to understand about the heavenly presence of God. Yeah, so I think it's much more of a loose connection than a causal. Other questions? Other questions? All right, well, let's end by going back to Exodus. Go back with me to Exodus 25, please. Let's go back to Exodus 25. And let's remember the very original purpose for why we're studying the tabernacle. Exodus 25, verse 8. God here says to Moses, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. I'm going to break this verse apart a little bit. Exodus 25, 8. And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Moses is told, let them make me a what? A sanctuary. Any other translations there? Okay, what is a sanctuary? Break the word apart. Okay, great. Break the word apart. Sanctuary. What is the word sanct, that root? What does that mean? Sanct's holy. Holy. So like sanctification, sanctified. Same root word, sanctified, sanctification, is the root for sanctuary. Okay? But whereas sanctification is the process of holying, sanctuary is a place of holiness. So, more literally, what Moses is told, let them make me a holy house, a holy place, that I may dwell in their midst. The word dwell here, any other translations? Live is the verb tabernacle. Here's what he's told. Let them make me a holy place that I may tabernacle in their midst. Now, here's what's so fascinating. Why did the house have to be holy? Because God is holy. The whole theme of Exodus and Leviticus, God is holy. But how in the world could the creator of the universe, who is holy, come to dwell among sinful man? That's the conundrum in the question of the tabernacle. And that's the one that we're going to try to start to unfold. And you take that even a step further. How then could a holy God allow people into his heavenly presence to dwell with him? It doesn't make sense. But that's the reality, the gracious reality that we live with. And that's the story of the tabernacle. All right, closing comments as we close. Charlene. Yes, the holy place. I'm going to talk about that in, it's either next week or 2 weeks. Give me a second. Let me remember what next week is. 2 weeks. I'm going to talk about that question in 2 weeks. Charlene's question was, how is it possible that God was here for, 1,000-ish? A 1,000-ish years. If you include Herod's temple, 1,500 years. How is it possible that God could dwell here, but now he dwells in the heart? And is God anywhere else? Or was he just constrained here? Excellent question. 2 weeks, we're going to talk about that in a bit more depth. I don't want to give you a superficial answer because that's a really good question. Bonnie? Good question. Yeah, good question. Numbers 4 is going to give some detail into this, and we'll talk about that, about the repairing and the beautifying, etc. But a lot of it is going to be original tabernacle. Now, that'll be lost after Babylonian captivity, and Zerubbabel and Joshua are going to have to redo a lot of this. But from 1500 to around 586, a lot of it's the same. All right, well, thank y'all so much for your comments and observations this morning.